You're listening to the Healthcare Goes Digital podcast. Get ready to be inspired as we explore provocative topics surrounding innovative technologies and ideas with top industry professionals as we help to positively disrupt healthcare. At Impetus Digital, we believe that everything starts with a thought as we aspire to act as the bridge to ignite these courageous conversations, both through our Insight platform and through these fireside chats. Let's get started with your host, Natalie Eden, Managing Director and co-owner of Impetus Digital, an all-in-one virtual collaboration solution for online meetings, events, and advisory boards.
Hi, everybody. My name is Natalie Eden, and I'm the co-owner and managing director with Impetus Digital. For those of you who do not know what Impetus Digital is, we're a company that has curated and built some of the best-in-class asynchronous and synchronous virtual collaboration tools in the Impetus Insight platform. And we allow life science companies to have advisory boards, working groups, investigator meetings, patient boards, market access collaborations, all online. Certainly, this has been unfortunate since the COVID-19 pandemic, but we've also been virtualizing a lot of people's internal meetings, POA rollouts, internal training, et cetera. One of the things that we do believe at Impetus is that everything starts with a conversation. And sometimes these big, hairy, audacious, and provocative conversations are just the thing that we need to help us progress along the lines of positive healthcare disruption. So really, the premise behind some of these conversations and our collaboration with the transformative technology community, in which I'm the leader of in Toronto, where the mission for the TTC is to impact the lives of a billion people by the year 2030. And we believe in wellness and flourishing and the promise of health and transcendence for everybody on Earth. So we really feel that the two mergings of those philosophies brings us to the table today to have these kinds of courageous conversations with people like Jordan Mills, where we're doing things that are interesting and new and slightly outside of the norm and out of the box, so that we can truly look at things differently in healthcare. And how can we not, after the pandemic and all the other things that are going on in the world around us today? So very, very happy to have Jordan Mills. And just to introduce her, I'm so happy and honored to have such a brilliant, smart, inspiring entrepreneur at the table today. She is the CEO of Mirror Me 3D, which is one of the first and only companies in the world who's bringing 3D printing to, yes, you're going to hear it, cosmetic surgery. You wouldn't really normally combine the two, but yes, there is actually a combination there. And they're merging the latest technologies in virtual surgical simulation and 3D printing. So very exciting stuff that we're going to delve into today. Mirror Me 3D is revolutionizing the overall plastic surgery experience for surgeons and patients alike. And they've personalized 3D models can be used to improve the consultation process, as well as to serve as a reference tool in the operating room to optimize results. So very, very happy to have you here, Jordan. Thank you for coming to our fireside chat.
Thanks for having me.
So I think we would be remiss in the world and everything that's going on around us where we wouldn't just sort of, you know, air a little bit here. Other people who might be coming in, not only from international, who might be listening to this internationally, but certainly all of our friends and family in the US. Tell us where you're located and kind of what's going on for you right now, and what are things like feeling for you in midst of what's going on with the protests right now?
Yeah, so I live and work here in New York City, in the U.S. It's been a week, probably 10 days, of having a bit of a heavy heart, having to face some of the problems in my country in a really big way. The positive side is the show of support, finally, that you seem to have people across all spectrums of socioeconomic or race or ethnicity, gender, showing up to cause change and cause good change that we already probably think should have happened and somehow hasn't. So I'm excited to be here and to do that, but for sure, a time to remember a lot of people right now.
Absolutely. And we are with you, and our thoughts, prayers, and just being there to listen to everybody speaking right now. And I think that's probably one of the key things that we should all be doing. So thanks for sharing that with us. So moving on, I wanted to get, you know, we actually have an ecosystem of entrepreneurs, many people who are in the wellness space, mental health. We also have a lot of pharmaceutical, like science, medical device companies that are going to be very interested in your story as an entrepreneur. So maybe we can just start from the very beginning. How did you get to where you are in the first place? Tell us, you know, in your summarized version, what brought you here?
A lot of things have gone exactly as they needed to for me to end up where I am. And I don't like to attribute my success so far to luck, but sometimes it does feel that way. I think the biggest reason I am where I am today is I have very good mentors growing up. I've had mentors that I've known for decades at this point. And so they're definitely a reason that I can sit here and talk to you as CEO of MirrorMe. I've been an entrepreneur, I guess, my whole life. The first thing I ever did as a kid was I would pick all the pecans in our yard and I would go and sell them at the top of my street. I wasn't especially business savvy. My mom has a photo of I would sell you one for 5 cents or like three for 12 cents or something. Whatever it was, the math wasn't quite right, but I always did really well. I would sell out. Maybe my parents were calling their friends. But I think I did that starting like 7 or 8 years old. And I've just, you know, always, I think I was born a creator, and I'm really lucky to have a mom who supported that. There's no, you know, should you do this or shouldn't you do this? It's really, we'll go ahead and try. I guess, you know, here I am.
Fantastic. So if you were speaking to another aspiring entrepreneur, and there's a lot of controversy these days, is do you take a gap year, you know, with all the tumults after the COVID-19 pandemic? Do you go, you join the Peace Corps to build your relationships as schools and universities try to figure things out? And then you battle things back and forth between Ivy League schools versus not, and getting the right education versus dropping out and just becoming an entrepreneur and, you know, building a gazelle company. Yeah. What advice would you give to a budding entrepreneur at any stage in their life? Do you think that there's, you know, is education and getting the MBA what's required? Or what did you think were some of those magic nuggets that you would give as advice to somebody looking to starting a company?
Yeah, I will say I don't have an MBA. I did study for a long time. I studied first finance and then actually interior architecture, which is sort of the convergence of building a business and also the 3D design and printing side of things. I would say I didn't do a gap year, but I strongly encouraged my younger sister to. I think that we have to give ourselves time to explore. And I think that it's very easy to run, but you want to find problems that are interesting to you, that you can be really curious about. You know, if you find yourself wanting to talk to the person on the airplane sitting next to you about this idea that you have, it's probably worth pursuing, right? If it's an idea you're sort of like, yeah, maybe not. Starting anything is really hard. Going from zero to something is very hard. So make sure it's something you have an innate curiosity for. And sometimes you need to go to school to find it, and sometimes you don't.
So how did you get your inspiration? You're not a surgeon.
Yeah.
And so how on earth did Jordan end up connecting into, of all things, cosmetic surgery? So what was the impulse or the question that started this for you?
So I actually joined with a surgeon. Carrie Stern is our founder as well. And she's a plastic surgeon at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and she does plastic and reconstructive surgery for breast reconstruction, so oftentimes after cancer. And Mira and me, we definitely started in cosmetic surgery, but today we actually do just as much reconstructive surgery. So congenital defects, trauma, cancer reconstruction, facial reconstruction, transgender cases for people making a transition. We've grown our tentacles significantly. But I got here because I'd come out of another startup and I was looking for an interesting problem to work on. I expected to take 6 months off just to give myself a breather. And I met Carrie and ended up only taking 6 weeks off before jumping in. When I first started, I told Carrie, I was like, Carrie, I'm not a doctor. I'm probably like the wrong person to do this. And, but I was so curious by it. Again, goes back, I guess, to curiosity. Like, why don't doctors use 3D? I live in 3D and I came from a world of architecture and design where everything is done in 3D. So, you know, it was just interesting convergence of all of those things.
Which is beautiful. Tell us a little bit about the first startup. Did you go into that right away after graduation? What brought you into the startup world? Because it is different than the typical, you know, like you were saying, get the MBA or the formal professional designation and work for a big company and work your way up. So what brought you into that first startup and what exactly was it and what were you working on?
So the first startup I was a part of, we did pricing for SaaS companies. So how do you maximize your revenue by increasing lifetime value, minimize customer acquisition cost, increase retention, all those types of questions. I started actually when I was in school. Part-time, and the more I did it, the more I knew that was where I belonged, what I wanted to work on. So I made sure I carved a nice path for me in the company. I made sure I had the skills that they would need for me, and grew it from there. So when I first started, there were four, and when I left, I think there were about 27. They're still going, very successful, great, great group of people. I just wanted to go out on my own.
Right. Good for you. So you have this entrepreneurial bent to you that you guys always kind of propelled to being in a place of, I guess, freedom and open thinking and not kind of being in a regimental space.
Yeah. I've never not worked in a startup. I feel like I'm one of the luckiest people in the world and every day I'm working on something that I'm also creating. And I think that's probably what draws people to startups.
Absolutely. So what were some of the key learnings from that first experience that you find you still institute and leverage in being the CEO of your own company now?
Good question. It's probably a litany of things. I think some of the biggest lessons are love your customers. If you love talking to your customers and you keep your ear to the ground, both in terms of how you're serving them today, but what's still missing from what they would like to do and how you can incorporate that into your product path. I think, you know, we had a really good team that was really fortunate to have some really good advocates up front. And as soon as I came to Miramie, I went on the road for 8 months to find those people. And I talked to anyone who would talk to me. That was a plastic surgeon. How are you doing this today? What do you wish you could do? What can't you do? Even if it wasn't quite related to Miramie, I wanted to hear everything. I think startups can be great synthesizers, both of what is today and what needs to be tomorrow. So I think that's one of the biggest lessons. And then maybe the next one is form a team that inspires you, form a team that you want to work for, even on a Saturday morning. Those are the people who get you through the long nights, get you through the rough weeks. You become your own family if done well. And I think that that's really important to the success of anyone in a startup as well.
So are you still with your business partner, Carrie? And if you were to give advice to other people who are considering the idea of creating a company with other co-founders, I know you were mentioning some ideas right there, but how have you managed through the inevitable periods of conflict, What sort of advice would you give of just sort of managing those things so that you're streamlining process of basically the next important relationships besides, you know, somebody that you're married to? How have you navigated those sometimes difficult and challenging waters?
I am not scared of difficult conversations. I'm definitely not scared of iteration. Sometimes we try something, it doesn't go exactly as we wanted, or it doesn't go as well as we wanted. And it's really setting a culture of negative tests aren't failures. That's something I repeat a lot. It's okay to iterate. And I think early on with anyone, I try as quickly as possible to allow tough conversations to bubble up. I can be quite blunt. And I don't do it because I only want to talk about the bad stuff, but I definitely think that problems you don't talk about only get bigger. And you know, of course there's a way to do it. You can do it respectfully. You can do it without making it seem, you know, that you're attacking ideas or attacking the feelings of other people. When you have a tough conversation, you have to keep it about facts and about work and about, you know, numbers. And it works as long as you're considerate of the people you're speaking with.
Love it. So you went out talking to a whole bunch of people. It was almost like a face-to-face market research that you were doing, and you learned everything you could about the cosmetic surgery space, you know, all that sort of stuff. What made you say, okay, here's my business idea? How did you create the idea? And is it the same idea, what you're doing today? Is it exactly the same vision that you had back in the day when you decided to incorporate?
The vision today is even bigger than where it started, which is really, some of it is exactly as I thought it would play out. I tend to be someone who dreams big. I tell anyone on the team, listen, starting something's hard, you might as well go for it. And, you know, when I started, I made a list of, you know, as many different types of users. And every time I had a conversation, I refined the list or I added to it. You know, what kind of surgeon were they? What kinds of patients were they serving? How often were they in surgery versus consulting versus all the different things doctors do? If they were using 3D technology, how are they using it? And so, after enough information, I just synthesized things, and you know, I had different categories of people. I looked at who could I serve the fastest, who could I serve the best, who could I serve, and they would be sort of after the chasm, the early-ish adopters, but they weren't going to be that initial group that really saw our success. I allowed everything I learned about our customers really to drive the vision of what this needed to be. We're fortunate in that we serve doctors, but we also serve patients because doctors serve patients. So I talked to patients too about, you know, what do you think about a doctor using this? What would you like to see from a doctor who's using this? So we have a patient side of things as well as a doctor side now.
So once you actually had a really solid business plan, and it sounds like it was extremely customer centric, and you had a solid client avatar that you built, did you then go around to, you know, to look for funding? What was the next step that you took as an entrepreneur building your company? What exactly did you do with that information?
Yeah, we had just some friends and family early on. And then a strategic partner came in and invested in us, which was super helpful to have both their name and their financial support. That helped us get through the pains of figuring out the right product, how to package it, how to serve our customers. What was the experience of MirrorMe, not just the product of MirrorMe? And we've slowly, you know, worked up from there. And just earlier this year, raised another bit of money to get us to the next 15 to 18 months of growth, which I think we'd be ready for Series A by then.
Yeah, which is amazing. So let's just say, for example, I'm an investor, I'm a venture fund, and you're in front of me. How would you describe what MirrorMe does? Like, what was your pitch? What were the key concepts, the value proposition? How did you sell the ideas? Just basically for everybody around the table, to get a high glimpse of what it is that your company does?
So at the highest level, the goal of MiraMe is that all patients everywhere receive the best possible care. And that is ensured by giving doctors the best possible tools. A lot of patients who can afford the very best doctors in the world get the best finishes or the best results. And that's not, doesn't seem to trickle out everywhere all the time. So the goal of MiraMe is to give tools that are patient specific to doctors, with the hopes of reducing revision rates, which revision rates are extremely high for soft tissue surgeries. Traditionally, soft tissue has been hard to predict. We're helping increase the predictability of soft tissue, as well as giving surgeons plans for exactly what they're hoping to achieve. That's the high level. The small level is, you know, we have the 3D printed models, we have the 3D printed guides and templates. We now have 3D printed splints that are patient specific, that are just for rhinoplasty today, but showing about a 30% better control in swelling over the first 4 weeks. And then on the inside, we're building out a surgical guidance system delivered via augmented reality that takes all the 3D printed things that we do and delivers it through a digital experience. Which decreases the cost of working with us, which hopefully increases access to everyone having this technology.
Oh, wow. So there's a lot there and a lot of really cool things that you're doing.
Yeah.
So let's actually sort of dissect the first piece, which is a core component of the aids and the guidance and the you know, those things that you're actually creating as tools are 3D printed. Tell us a little bit about how you learned about 3D printing. You know, how have you built this so that it actually is scalable? You know, so just really some of the premise around that piece of technology that's a core basis of what MiraMe does.
Sure. So 3D printing, the first time I 3D printed was actually in school for when I was studying architecture. A class, I think it was my second to last semester, we built a 3D printer, obviously primitive. It was a while ago, but that was, you know, I've always been pretty a hands-on person. I like to build things in general. So that was the first time I 3D printed, and I sort of, you know, played on and off with it, always followed it since then. For here, again, it goes back to being willing to iterate. I would just print and print and print all kinds of shapes to understand. Most people think a 3D printer is sort of like a microwave, like you just tell it to go and it's going to do something good. It works, but it's maybe not accurate. We like to say that we're within a millimeter of accuracy. So we have to be really careful about orientations and viscosity and all kinds of components that creates a successful 3D print that is accurate, not just looks like it's supposed to. I think we've done over 300 tests of different types of things on the kind of printer that we use for our models is different than for our splints and our guides. So, you know, testing everything, documenting everything, trending for positive results. I guess I had a few mentors who taught me a lot about 3D printing as well. And I'm a pretty avid reader, so I read up on things. Although I feel like by the time you read a book about technology, it's a little bit obsolete. So I guess that's how I learned. Nowhere formally, just completely trial.
So what does the scalability of that look like? So let's just say, for example, you were planning or you're planning to work on this nationally, internationally. Whenever the typical person like me thinks of a 3D printer, we think about the little, you know, box that goes on. And do you have an entire warehouse of these boxes all kind of machining at the same time? I mean, what does the scalability of that 3D printing concept look like? And is it, you know, is each thing that you're feeding into it, is it a template? Is it based on the specific metrics measured for per patient? Like, what does that scalability look like?
A little bit of that is proprietary, but we have refined a process that's very scalable in terms of taking patient-specific information and outputting a template or a guide or a model useful by the surgeon. In addition to printing ourselves, we have partners who help us with increased demand or those types of things. We have some really actually incredible partners who understand that we work on the time of the surgeon, and oftentimes that's rushed. So we have some long days simply because cases are happening, although not in the current environment. It's a little slower, but it can happen within 48 hours of us receiving information.
Right. Sounds really, really interesting. So you also mentioned that a new, newer dimension to what you're doing is, besides providing these more accurate guides that are very personalized for patients, that so when they're obviously added, it decreases inflammation and other things that would have happened if something didn't quite fit right. You know, so there's all kinds of other great parameters associated with having something that's uber personalized when we talk about precision medicine. You also talked about being able to augment the process using augmented reality. So maybe you can talk to us a little bit about what is AR and how are you employing that as part of this precision medicine process that you've created?
So the guiding vision of why it's important is that 3D printing is time intensive. It's a form of manufacturing, even though it is an accessible form of manufacturing, but to do it well does take a little bit of time. The goal of augmented reality was to further drive down the cost of personalized care because it's delivered digitally versus, you know, cost of goods for material and shipping and everything else. But still give as accurate of indications for what the surgeon is hoping to achieve for that patient or for that case. I say or for that case because some patients have multiple cases before a final result. So instead of waiting for our guides or our models, we can project directly onto the patient. We can project a photorealistic simulation or different types of maps or contours that explain the rebuild of the new anatomy or the change of existing anatomy, all those types of things. So it's just like our models, our splints, our guides, but digital.
Fantastic. And you are obviously very heavy in some of the latest bleeding edge technologies. I mean, some people are just trying to catch up to doing, you know, telemedicine, right? So you're talking about some really far ahead sorts of things. But with all of that said, we also realize that because you're doing a lot of work right now in cosmetic surgery, and we're going to talk a little bit about what some of your future aspirations are, but have you or are you going to be considering other sorts of leading edge technologies like facial recognition software and utilizing that to help with developing the guides and sort of the prints for what your machine printing and, you know, and on it goes. Is that part of the plan or is there too much controversy in that software for you to start delving into it?
So facial recognition isn't part of the plan for MirrorMe per se. Number one, we take privacy incredibly serious. Not just because we have to, but because I think of if I was a patient, what would I want my data exposed to? So everything is really nicely siloed. Patient data is not shared internally at all or externally with doctors or anyone else unless the patient okays it. What we are working towards in terms of automation and machine learning is identifying on a patient-specific level deformities or defects or things that need to change. That's not quite facial recognition, but probably sort of parallel to it. But we don't, when we do patient-specific medicine, we don't match anything to a normal or to a standard. Everything is truly patient-specific.
You bring up something that's really interesting about machine learning, neural networks, the predictive markers of what things look like. And you're talking also about the ever-changing structure of how things meld and mold. We all know, for example, when you put braces in, the mouth and the teeth continue to move. And I'm sure the same thing happens with other sorts of insertions and other things like that as well. But also the curious question about child development. And like you were saying, of predictions of what something like, i.e. a deformity, would look like in terms of progressing and doing the forecasting and the reshaping. Are those some of the things that you're forecasting for Mirror Me in the future?
Yeah, we actually already do some of that today. If we get, you know, we serve children as much as we serve adults on the reconstructive side. So if a child has an injury or something that causes a deformity or a defect of some sort, we can help simulate what the patient needs to look like per an idealized result, and then give the doctor that information. We don't do a lot in terms of, and maybe this is what you're actually asking, if we get a 7-year-old patient, what that patient looks like at 20. That's not really where we're going with things. We do study the change of soft tissue over time from an anti-aging perspective, facial rejuvenation perspective. Our faces really do carry our life with us in a lot of ways. If you sleep on your left side every single night, you'll actually have more volume on your left face than your right, which most people won't be able to tell, but we can. Or, you know, different things like that. So our faces are ever changing as we live and breathe. Depending on your diet, all kinds of things can determine, you know, how your face and your soft tissue really appears.
Right. That's fascinating. I just think it is an absolutely fascinating area. You mentioned again some really great positive outcomes, and certainly I think there's some huge value proposition here in terms of cost savings, especially when you're talking, when you add in the cost associated with multiple revisions or refits and things like that, the costs associated with managing like excessive inflammation and the medication costs of those and back and forth. And I think there's a quality of life piece to this. Have you ever collated a whole value proposition in terms of looking for more public payers to be paying for these sorts of things? Or is this still in the hands of the patients themselves feeling that this was important enough for them to pay for this directly?
We are starting to become vendors of hospitals and hospitals. So the problem with healthcare from a public side is that you have the jungle, shall we say, of reimbursements and CPT codes, and ultimately who pays for what and can we get it for the cheapest cost ever. We are starting to have some progress on that internationally, nationally. International is doing a little bit better than the US in terms of regulating 3D technology for healthcare. But we're starting to make progress there. People are starting to successfully add us to the OR bill and get reimbursed for it on reconstructed cases. Just as important as, you know, having the right screw or custom plating or something during reconstruction is having the right tools to help you achieve what you want to achieve. And I think that case is quickly becoming made for us. There's tons of peer-reviewed journals that discuss the benefits of 3D printing and 3D printed or 3D guided tools. It's very close to my heart to serve everyone. I don't want to only serve people that can afford this. So
it really is brilliant and a really, really innovative idea. So outstanding. Now we also are hearing a lot more, you know, again, unfortunately from post COVID-19, that regulatory agencies like the FDA, like the NIH and many others across the world are accelerating, modifying their approval policies, et cetera, especially around things like prescriptive digital therapeutics and other sorts of medical devices. Is this something that your company is considering going down the road of becoming a prescriptive, you know, therapeutic or device in the future?
So we are already registered with the FDA as a manufacturer of the splints. We will certainly, for the augmented reality guidance system, we'll go into testing for this officially later this year. And we will be technically, I believe, a class 2 device because you can do diagnostic information from how our machine works. So yes, we will be regulated. We already are regulated in many senses. We have a full quality management system, as well as design controls, version controls for everything. And we're very much prepared for it. I think that it's exciting to see change happening in healthcare, for telehealth and that sort of thing. But you know, I don't like to make the FDA or our regulatory bodies sort of the villains here. I think that they serve a really important purpose of ensuring patient safety on anything brought into the market. But very encouraging to see them looking towards the future finally, which is awesome.
Yeah, it really is. And it's exciting to see what the future looks like there. Another key component here also in terms of ease of use, always, especially when we're talking about technology, oftentimes comes down to the issue around interoperability. Being able to ensure that information, data, et cetera, is easily related and accessible through mechanisms that the physicians are already using, be it electronic medical records or health records or what have you. Where is your systems from an interoperable standpoint fair in this equation?
Yeah, I will confess that we run parallel to most of those systems today. We're dealing with 3D data, and we have just a completely different experience than a bunch of form fields that you see in an EMR. It's been a strategic decision on my part from a messaging perspective that we don't want to be a billing system. We want to be a care system, and we aren't interested in physician burnout. We're interested in facilitating the physician's job to be easier, to be faster or more efficient, not give them even more things to check on. Another way we approach this slightly differently is that if you as a patient have a MirrorMe profile, you can upload all of your 3D data and add doctors to it. So any doctor anywhere, someone in your hometown, a specialist across the world, you can share your information and have a consultation with them. And they'll be able to see your data just as though you gave them a CD in person of all of your data. And it stays with the patient for as long as they have a MirrorMe profile. So although we aren't currently integrating with things on the market quite yet, we are very much thinking about patient data belongs in the hands of patients, and how do we make sure it stays there versus gets locked away inside of, you know, a facility that doesn't want to let go of it.
So I know that when we talked a little bit earlier before we started, you're a big proponent around patient privacy, healthcare data ownership. With all of that said, and since you and your company are really far ahead in terms of technology adoption and creation, have you been considering the use of blockchain as it relates to the holding of this data so that that patients truly own their own information?
I think blockchain is still in its nascent form in some ways for healthcare. I can say here's what we're doing similar to blockchain. Anytime someone touches the data of a patient, the patient knows about it. Patient data doesn't get shared without patients agreeing to it. The way that we've siloed everything is that if you think of everything as a block, all data blocks, which is a piece of patient data, is only assigned to the patient. And a patient can get assigned to a doctor, and then doctors obviously to clinics or healthcare systems. But really, we put the patient above their data. We don't put the data between the patient and the doctor. And I feel that is, you know, very important to ensuring patients, you know, when I say I would put my own data in here, and I do, I trust who I share it with. I know who it's shared with. I can take people off of my profile. We have a whole process for that.
I love it. And it really is the description of blockchain. And it sounds like you're sort of creating it, which is brilliant. Now, with all that said, I mean, how do patients have access to their data? Is it an app? Is it some sort of a web interface? Is it another third-party service where you basically load that data that they have the processes in place to do as you've suggested, or what exactly is it?
So we have a patient web app. As of today, we're working on a mobile app. The reason we have been slow on the mobile app side is just because the data sets that we're working on are huge. They don't load well in mobile, but we have overcome that, and we're working on a solution to at least have some functionality on the go. But you know, this is your health data. We don't want you accidentally exposing it, so we've had to be really cautious about the security of a mobile app, since it is on a phone and our phones go everywhere. But you can sign up if you have existing 3D data. You can hop on a quick call with us. We can help you upload it and sort it. You can upload both 2D photos that are important to you for, you know, tracking progress over time, as well as 3D. And our mobile app will actually have a patient scanner for iOS users. And so patients will be able to scan themselves in 3D and track their progress either ahead of surgery or postoperatively.
Wow, very cool. I'm assuming that part of this process of this app, like you said, is they're taking photos of themselves and this gets uploaded into the system. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, you can take photos or actual 3D scans.
Nice. Very, very cool. I love it. So as we're sort of looking at this and looking at the progress of you and your company as a whole, you now have this really great place. How would you describe to this ecosystem of other entrepreneurs and small companies, as well as other big companies, what your voyage was like in accessing your first 100 customers? What was your process of doing that? Was it just word of mouth? I mean, based on the kind of work you do, was it because of your business partner? How did you acquire your customers?
And I mean, all of those avenues. The best way was through advocacy of our early customers. So we had a few doctors who were quite well respected, if not, and obviously I'm biased, but truly I believe some of the best in the world advocate for what us, and not only are they advocating for us on the outside, they're advising us on the inside. So we are constantly getting surgeon feedback, and I think that we've been able to differentiate ourselves from other would-be competitors in that we work with surgeons so closely, from the ideation to development to actual delivery. Other than that, obviously sort of in, as any startup, brute force, talk to anyone who will answer the phone, email everyone who, you know, will respond. We went to a few industry shows. Those were okay. I think most people sort of think if you aren't one of the biggest vendors there, you do get drowned out, and I would support that a bit. But we were lucky to have some people, because we are on the cutting edge of things. They wanted to publish on us, which helped. So we provided them stuff for the study. We didn't pay for the studies. A few of the studies were surprises to us, but that's also helped.
That's really cool. And again, because you are working in bleeding edge space, you are working with sometimes very traditional types of physicians. How have you overcome some of the adoption rates and objections?
I'm from the South. I can be very patient. I've had many doctors tell me, you know, I think this is great, but I'm about to retire. I'm not changing my whole way of doing this yet. And so I'll have a conversation with them, sort of how you earlier in this call said everything starts with a conversation. As soon as someone tells me that they don't think this is for them, that's the person I really want to talk to and ask them, you know, well, why not? What are you doing today that is better than this? Or, and actually at a show, a doctor told me I'll never use this stuff. And he came back the next day at the same show, and I asked him, I was like, I'm really curious to know why you had such a hard opinion about this. And we talked and we talked and we talked. And finally it ends with, you know, if you could have a guide that measures the thing you wanted to measure, maybe I would use it. So I took an Uber to a craft store. I believe this was in Chicago. I bought a bunch of materials that I could make, prototype essentially. I bought mesh wire and tape and glue and scissors and anything I might need overnight to produce this prototype. And I took it back to him the next day. And he is now a customer, and he brought on someone else as a customer.
Wow. And that just goes to show you like determination and like lugging your 3D printer with you on your trips always plays off, just joking. So I think that is brilliant. It really shows the level of customer centricity. And we're really looking, like you said, not only personalized medicine as it relates to patients, but personalized customer centricity as it relates to the care, to the physician. You know, getting that level of interest and intrigue. I mean, I'm sure you just blew them away by the fact that you just did that. So really kudos to you to show that level of focus. So when we also talk about partnerships, we're also talking about big players. You're obviously having received funding from, you know, a myriad of different funders, but have you also considered partnerships? You and I have talked in the past because we come from a place of, you know, big medical device and pharmaceutical companies and other life science healthcare stakeholders, always looking for the next thing, either A, to extend their patent, issues or expiries, to wanting to expand to create some value, opportunities to differentiate versus their pill competitors. You know, what is kind of going on in that world for you to think about partnerships moving forward?
I am a huge proponent of partnerships. I think the more we work together, the faster we'll go in terms of changing healthcare. Late last year, we signed a distribution deal with Stryker, the craniomaxillofacial division, to distribute our models. So that has been a huge win for us as a startup to be looked at by them and then considered and ultimately trusting us to deliver this product. I think that there are some other potential partnerships for the app, especially in facial rejuvenation and the cosmetic procedures. But from a doctor perspective, I can tell you we get quite a few phone calls from doctors every week asking if we want to license their patent or different things like that. I've been pretty cautious on those types of things. Mirami has a strong patent portfolio as it is for most of the things we're working on. But there's no shortage, I think, of people who see our enthusiasm for patient-specific care who are asking to join us or looking for ways to join us.
Very neat. And I can just imagine, I think that's extremely exciting. So as we sort of project into the future, what is next for MirrorMe? Right now you work in the cosmetic surgery space, but what else, since you have a bigger vision for giving the best healthcare to patients?
So in our immediate future, it is getting ready to trial our augmented reality guidance system for soft tissue surgeries. Today we are strictly head and neck. We are in the prototype and development stage for extending our service to breast reconstruction. Obviously Carrie, she does breast reconstruction, so it's near and dear to our hearts. But the future is really about, number one, decreasing the amount of time it takes for a surgeon to have patient-specific care, and number two, to reduce the cost of it. So I think those are our North Stars in terms of, are we achieving the things we need to achieve, and everything else is just tactical things, a part of the product plan.
So as we move forward and we think about emerging from the quarantines and the hibernation as we move into the new normal, what does that look like, and how has COVID-19 impacted MirrorMe, and what is the forecast for the future?
We were 100% affected by COVID. Because the types of surgeries that we are part of are non-emergent cases. So we saw business actually come to a total standstill. Scary for sure, especially when we started the year with so much momentum. But we're starting to see trickles of life again across the country. We actually had a surgeon this morning upload 14 cases. We expect actually a pretty busy summer for people trying to make up for lost revenue. We're hearing lots about hospitals trying to have their ORs open even more than they already do to make up for lost revenue. We're hoping not for a second wave in the fall, but if there is one, we'll do our part as citizens and stay home and figure out how to go from there.
Beautiful, love it. So if you were leaving just a final remarks to new companies, entrepreneurs, small businesses, or even larger companies, what's the one hope that you have for healthcare moving forward?
I think don't be scared to tackle hard things, and don't lose sight of your original vision. You can take a lot of shortcuts to faster revenue. You can take a lot of shortcuts to, you know, selling yourself more quickly or growing more quickly. I think healthcare needs some big ideas. And to our investors who have been so supportive of our timeline and having the chance to get things really and truly right, not just out, I think that's key.
That's awesome. I just want to thank you very much, Jordan, for a fantastic conversation. Wishing you and your company so much great luck. I think there is some amazing things that you have ahead, and I think we're all anxiously awaiting to see some of the fantastic impact that you're going to have moving forward. For the rest of you, I want to let you know that I will be leaving links to MirrorMe's website as well as Jordan's LinkedIn profile if any of you are interested in contacting her directly. In that description, we'll also be leaving you with links to Impetus Digital. And as I was mentioning, if anybody's interested in having some more of these sorts of discussions, figuring out how to leverage 3D printing, augmented reality, or even some of the work that Jordan's doing, you know, some of these provocative conversations that are pushing healthcare in a forward, disruptive manner, that's exactly what we do. We're the bridge for those courageous conversations in advisory boards, focus groups with all of your allied healthcare stakeholders. So please look out for us on YouTube, Twitter. We'll be leaving links to our blog articles. And so we'd love you to subscribe and look for those as well. So thank you to everybody, also the TransTech community. We will be leaving links as well too. So best wishes to all of you. Thank you, Jordan, for your time. And wishing everybody a wonderful day ahead.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this Healthcare Goes Digital podcast. Impetus Digital are the business-to-business advisory board experts and provide virtual collaboration solutions for meetings, events, and projects worldwide. Visit us at impetusdigital.com to find out more and subscribe to our LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube to stay up to date about other upcoming inspiring conversations.